This is the thing, the shape I'm best known for. It's called the Mandelbrot set. Advertisement for a bakery. So it says Mandelbrot Menge, it's in German. And it was done by Springer, which is a publisher. It's a very, very commercial thing. I shudder at the taste it has. So it has the same thing. Okay, so. But you can find the Mandelbrot sets everywhere. In spring, all that is red azaleas.
Red azaleas?
Yes. It's amazing. It's 10 feet tall and 20 feet wide. And, well, rhododendrons also. But azaleas are more visible. We used to bring buckets of that to the previous owners, because they are nice people, but they passed on, so we are never here in May, so it's not so interesting. But the snow in April, what do you think of snow in April? Is that incredible?
It's pretty amazing, isn't it, when you think about this spring?
Yes, as a child I was born in Warsaw, and the national holiday was the 3rd of May. It's Independence Day in Poland, or something of this sort, Constitution Day. But very often it snowed after Constitution Day.
Really, really, in Poland. My mother was born in Poland too, in Warsaw.
I was born in Warsaw. Well, so.
And when did you leave?
In 36.
36. Where did you go?
To Paris.
To Paris, yeah. That's where some of my family, my mother's family went to Paris also.
Yeah.
We're in this fractal storm here, a snowstorm. How do you think about snow and fractals? I mean, they're all different. What's the relationship?
Well, trees are fractal, very much so. That's the example of fractals, best example. Snowflakes are fractal, but it's a very complicated story. So I don't actually think about these matters when I look at snow. I think at trees, certainly. Some trees here, this big one.
So when you see trees, you think of them as?
Oh, certainly. And trees, in our temperate climate, trees are very boring, not have many different shapes. But if you go to other climates, you see many more complicated structures. And if you look at trees from dim past, the same. So it's interesting.
You said that when you were 19, you all of a sudden saw equations as images.
Well, all of a sudden, it's a gift I must have had before, but revealed itself. As a matter of fact, today I got a letter from a classmate. I'm writing my memoirs, and one never remembers. I mean, I would like not to say foolish things. So I wrote to this man, said, we're together in class then, do you remember what happened? Oh, he remembered very well. He said that I interrupted the teacher rather rudely, telling him that all these endless, ridiculous, endless, complicated calculations were completely unnecessary. It was obvious from a geometric viewpoint that the thing was some curve, which I knew. And the teacher said, well, do you think so? Why? Of course. Oh, yes, you are right. Of course. So it saved me. Actually, it's very interesting to say that a gift of this sort can save a person during a terrible time of the occupation. But that did.
And you were talking earlier about curiosity. What is that about?
Oh, I don't know. Curiosity. I was not properly socialized in school. That is, I never decided what I was. So, since I don't know whether I'm going to be a mathematician in the future or a writer or a historian, I keep my options open.
Still,
at this stage, of course, the future. But actually, the future doesn't look any longer today. In shorter today, and looked in 44, because at that time many futures were very rapidly terminated. But well, I'm curious, and it's a very cumbersome quality. As a matter of fact, I'm fighting against it. Most people fight the other way, but I fight against being drawn on a tangent, continuing an idea which may be fun, but maybe also get me nowhere. So the discipline that a scientist must have is paradoxical one, because on one hand you're very curious, but on the other hand, when you have you cannot let your curiosity completely free reign. You must be very, very tight and organized in developing it. That's a paradox of science, but that's not new. It's well known.
You reminded me of a quote I like from, of all people, we don't think about Henry Miller, when he asked, where do you get your inspiration? And he said, inspiration, oh, I hate inspiration. It consumes you, it's a fire, it eats you up, it burns you up, and he couldn't wait to get rid of it. And beside that, it's not you sitting right here. You know? And I just, oh, now there's somebody understood the paradox of creativity. And talk about creativity. What?
Oh, Lord, no, it's too much. It's too cold. The point is that in my case, creativity was very much linked to being, again, non-socialized. I spent 2 years in the Ecole Polytechnique, which is nominally a military academy in France. The first year I got the worst grade of for military behavior ever given in the school. The second year, my captain gave me average grade. Actually, those military people did not want to give high or low grades because they didn't want to intervene in the ranking of students, because their life could depend upon that. So, but in my case, they did it. And second year, the fellow said, after giving me a note, just average note, said, one should not perceive this, this cadet, because I was cadet, as being disobedient or against authority. He doesn't know what it means. Because I had learned during the war that authority and people who knew were not exactly the people who knew. There are some people who knew and they were making stupid mistakes, and I was really on my own. So I became rather impervious to the authority of people saying, this is impossible, this can't be done, this makes no sense. And so I've been fighting all my life for ideas which were initially very, very unpopular. And then after a while, people begin to say, it's quite obvious, that's fine. I've lived old enough to get to a stage where I can look at that after, you know, in a certain sense, after a span of life so long, it's almost like a new generation. A new life, a reincarnation, sort of, even though I'm the same body and the same.
I happen to be an inventor. And I realized a title of a book that I'm not writing, since you were talking to your publisher, is A Good Mistake. You have to make a lot of mistakes before you make a good one.
Well, but there's in Latin a word for it. It's an old story in Latin, and also in, I think, in Catholic tradition, but mostly in Latin. It's actually very understandable in English. It's felix culpa. Felix means happy, and culpa, mistake, error.
Oh, really?
So felix culpa is the prime mover of science. I made many, many, many fortunate mistakes. I did a theory of something that was, after I looked at it, quite ridiculous, but it was perfectly good theory of something else I was also interested in. So, science is like Napoleon was, you know, the story of Napoleon, when he was given the last sign up on some promotion of somebody to high rank in the army. He he, the first question after he read the casually the story, he said, "Well, all right, so he has done all the right things, but tell me, is he lucky?" And lucky means actually, does he know when things are turning really bad and know enough to get the hell out of there?
Well, it's funny because one of the quotes I like about Napoleon is
I hate Napoleon, incidentally. I think he was a terrible tyrant and had a horrible influence in the world, on France, and everything. But that doesn't mean that he was not a brilliant man. He was. Had he been less brilliant, the world would have been a much happier place.
This is probably true. But the interesting quote that I like, and I'm using in something else, is Napoleon realized he was invincible when he saw that people would die for a piece of ribbon, for a flag.
Yes, but then Napoleon, in 1807 or something, many of his principal servants, helpers, abandoned him. Because, for example, Talleyrand, who was the most brilliant of them all, provoked a quarrel with Napoleon to get fired, because one did not resign with Napoleon, one didn't go, one had to be fired. So he got into quarrel, and he felt that Napoleon could win a battle every year, once, twice, three times, but not forever and forever and forever. And after, I think, was it 07 or 08? He waited about the right time. After that, Napoleon went on winning a couple of wars, but then he, of course, was defeated in a Waterloo, which was a victory for France, because I think it's paradoxical that Waterloo is this Waterloo station in London and the Austerlitz station in Paris. But if Napoleon had won at Waterloo, it'd be a disaster of the most extraordinary proportion, because France was totally exhausted, bloodied and everything. It had been a total disaster to go on beyond. But at that point, Talleyrand had retired quietly many years before, was ready to serve the next prince, because Talleyrand was foreign secretary of France during the Revolution, during the Empire, and afterwards. He was a very, very brilliant man for his trade.
So it seems like you have a deep interest in the science of history.
Well, not science of history. The events of history are very often of moderate interest, but the way in which sometimes history is run by little things like the nose of Cleopatra in the classic story in France, in particular, or in sometimes by something very cosmic like 100,000 people fleeing famine or bad weather in Asia and destroying European civilizations. So history sometimes works on small things, on big things, and sometimes on details of great or lesser import in appearance. So that fascinates me. But I read more history than science when I was a child, and people want to think that if the child does not do enough science by age 18, it's lost forever. I think it's ridiculous. Mathematics in particular is not like violin playing, when you must start at 3 and otherwise you are lost. There have been some very great mathematicians who are very precocious, but by and large, great majority of major mathematicians have become have revealed themselves around 20 or 22 or 23, not before. And once they like it, they can catch in no time flat, because mathematics is very simple. But that's another story.
Curious, what would you say to people who wanted to be scientists, who were interested in science? What would you say to young people?
Well, read a lot, but also read history. I'm asked that all the time. People tell me, well, my son is so brilliant that he has already finished 3 years of college when he's a sophomore in high school, and there are no classes around in mathematics. I say, well, so don't take mathematics. Bert has read everything, so, well, take a slow flight around the world and think about it. I mean, this matter of being in a great hurry is it's fine, but it is not so essential.
And what are your passions these days?
Well, it's complicated. I'm automatically spending too much time writing memoirs, and that is sort of thinking about the past, which is fine, but the past is not the past, not the future. I'm putting some things together, which is rather interesting. This is less interesting than things that in the past. However, there's one aspect of that which may be called a passion. So again, the matter of age. So I was not precocious at all. In fact, one can be precocious in well-defined professions, but not in ill-defined ones. Violin playing is very well-defined, or piano playing, so you can be precocious then. Even mathematics, if you pick the parts of mathematics which are already established. But if you create your own world, which I did, it takes a very long time. Now I look at things I did 50 years ago, and it's strange. I have a very strong feeling that somehow I'm like a different person looking at it. And that's very amusing. So this thing of living a late phase of a life in which I can look at my early life. I have very good memories, I remember that. It is both my life and it's also very far. That's very amusing. Passion is not the right term, but it's a source of great amusement. And so I'm working on these books, realizing that something I didn't know how to do in my previous existence, I can do now instantly.
Interesting. Someone, historian, said when you look at history, history is really the fiction of facts, and he came up with a word called factions. It made me think about who wrote history and what perspective we have, and now doing your own memoirs or something like that, it's almost like, do you find yourself kind of romanticizing and recreating it and
changing I don't think I'm much romanticizing it, because, no, I don't think so. I'm simplifying. Of course, because if I begin to tell stories of not trivial stories, I mean, for example, one of my friends had not memoirs, but he had authorized a biography made of him for him. So he gave his papers to a writer who wrote a book. Well, so I know exactly every meeting that he attended in his life, and whether he traveled cattle class or soft class. I mean, I think it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't even mention such things. So it's a matter of selection, and there is detail at every scale. Do I avoid unpleasant memories? Well, one forgets unpleasant things by and large. So, I emphasize this memoir is not autobiography. I was told that one must make a very big difference. For example, autobiography, I should go to the library and ask people to release some letters about myself in the past and check about my recollections of how I reacted to this and this event. I don't. So I check some facts sometimes. I ask people to remember this, to see whether they remember it as I remember. But I don't want to give the impression that I'm reconstructing a nice story. I'm just trying to tell it as it comes back to me with some hair-raising episodes. But I'm very careful to say they're hair-raising, but I'm by no means heroic. I was very lucky to be in France during the war and not in Romania or Poland or
in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Or other places like that. And so I don't want to make it any more heroic, any any harder. In fact, I think it's an interesting antidote, because when people ask me about my experience in the war, they're surprised that France was not like Poland. Thank God it wasn't like Poland. Well, so I'm not trying to improve it. I'm trying to, certainly I must simplify. Some things are, how to say, just ordinary. I mean, everybody knows about, so why should I bother to repeat them? Other aspects are not ordinary. I lived in Poland and in France and America for a long time as a foreigner, in the sense that I was, but a resident foreigner. I was very much resident French. I spoke French perfectly. I write French extremely elegantly, but I had experiences which most people did not have in France. So I saw some things differently. Besides, I lived in America longer than France, so I see now France from an angle in which most Frenchmen don't see it. And the many aspects of France are, in fact, surprise people. And I say, of course, I didn't think of these terms, but so so this matter of in America, some aspects of America which people are not aware of. But I'm not trying to wage a campaign of anything. So, well, anyhow, I don't have to do it. I do it because I think there are some things that deserve to be said, and I would like to emphasize this. The main fact, which is the key fact of my life, is that by some obscure mechanism, I started as a maverick, because I was not properly socialized, because I did not choose early on what field I was going to go in. I seemed to change, hesitate, move around. And so to how do different societies react to people who are not simple members of society. That's something which certainly has been underdocumented enormously. Enormously. One documents that for writers, because somehow writers make a big deal about being different, even when they are not, or poets, different in ways which are not visible to the outside, but they perceive very strongly. I am not, don't try to be different in my dress or manners or anything, but in terms of experience, I had an experience which can be described as unique, because not only in science, I've been in different sciences, not as a visitor, but professionally. But I had much more contact with music and art than scientists usually have. Technical contact. It was not just a collection of miscellaneous activities, but it was all united by one idea which didn't exist early on, and which, how to say, was born by constant by use. And I don't know many examples of this type of development being documented. So I would like to document that. So passion, is the word passion appropriate for that? Yes, because nobody becomes a scientist, remains a scientist, without some compulsion, some passion. Where compulsiveness ends, where passion begins, is a tricky matter. Also the fact that I work as hard as I do at this point means that I do have that very strongly. But again, is passion, is compulsion? Who knows? But the pleasure of having done something which now has its own life is quite obvious, and I don't deny that.
You reminded me of something. Recently I wrote a poem which has no words, and it just has a title.
It's the longest poem imaginable.
Because it's supposed to live on inside the person. And the title of the poem was fear of obsession and the obsession with fear?
Well, I'm not very fearful, but I must be obsessive. I mean, actually, anybody who carries on science beyond necessary in sense of beyond getting tenure, such things must be obsessive. Of course, I'm very special because I got tenure for the first time when I was 75, which is rather extremely old age for that.
Well, you should be proud of yourself.
Actually, yes, and Yale is proud of it. They yes, in fact, I was for 35 years at IBM, and IBM didn't grant any tenure to anybody. And then after a few years at Yale, decided to give me tenure, and so everything was obeyed, and then I had to get a Yale degree, because Yale does not allow anybody who doesn't have a Yale degree to teach at Yale. So every professor newly appointed who is not a Yale graduate, which is a great majority, receives a Master's of Arts. And after giving me this Master of Arts, the president of Yale said, "I'm very proud of having a professor who not only beat the record of highest age at the first grant of tenure, but also went instantly the highest rank that Yale could afford." So I went very late, but right to the top. But that was not something I was dreaming of. It was just came as amusing detail. Well,
and just curious, if you could say something to the people of the future, what would you say to them?
I have not the foggiest idea. I think life is going to be more complicated than there was, because technology makes more complicated, but technology makes almost everybody's life more dependent upon the whole world. I mean, the globalization is not a matter of whether to suffer it. The world is globalized to an amazing degree compared to the world I knew during the war when I was living in the country in France. I knew very well the local people. Their world was very, very small. In fact, it was poor by French standards, but infinitely rich by the standards of elsewhere. But their life was very simple, there were very few possibilities. Now it's very complicated, and so I don't know. I have no advice. I'm certain I have no advice to give. Those who give advice on the future, I think, are counting on not being there when advice is proven to be ridiculous.
This is true. I'm curious, how do you see yourself?
What do you mean?
You know, when you think of yourself, how do you see yourself?
Well, again, what do you mean? I see myself in different ways, from different viewpoints. What are you interested in?
Just allowing you to fill in the blanks and think about what does it mean to be you? What is it like to be you?
Well, I think that I was certainly by genes, because the gifts that I have were present in my father's family, in my mother's family, so I inherited some of it. I survived the war well, that is, instead of being beaten, I became strengthened and very much confident in myself. And I had led a life which was freer than almost anybody else's, accomplished many things. I didn't expect the easy life, so I found it bearable. But what do you mean what I think of myself? I mean, I was very lucky. That was the main thing. I was lucky again, again, again. I was lucky in my parents. I was lucky that, again, I was in France and not in Poland at that time. I was lucky in my friends. I was lucky that France, during the war, in France, the two contrary pressures. I mean, France had an extraordinary admiration for school achievement. French society is very much meritocratic, and so good grades were a big component of my surviving, which that was luck, because the good grades were part of my education, part of my genetic inheritance, part of everything. Then, so I was just lucky. I took gambles of grotesque nature, which made me tremble after the fact. How could I have done that? How could I? I was offered all kinds of very easy lives at different times. I felt that they didn't fit me. I didn't take them, which was totally ridiculous, just totally. I was lucky to survive. If I had been much before, 10, 20 years before, the fact that I have a very good eye for a scientist would have been almost pointless. It served no purpose. So I was about right time to recreate a new extended hand, which is called computer graphics. Without computer graphics, I would have been very much inhibited. I don't know what I would have done. So all these things are lucky. On the other hand, I was very nimble on my feet. I might have done different things. But the matter of being an aging gambler who survived is that's probably what I could say I look myself as having been, because many of the things I started had very generally perceived as being absolutely hopeless. I had a different opinion, because being a serious gambler, I don't gamble just for the pleasure of gambling. In fact, I don't like the agony of waiting until it worked out. I can't imagine buying lottery tickets. It's to me an absurdity. I never bought a lottery ticket in my life. I was handed lottery tickets by life, and they were rather loaded. But I think that's about it.
What about, how did this fractal thing come to you? Where did that come from?
Oh, well, it's very complicated. First of all, and now I know, but it took me a very long time to find out that fractals were there forever. I mean, it's one of the most striking. Let me start by the end. So I had become a rather well-known scientist in many areas, working on things that nobody had been looking at. And to my amazement, some things I was doing, people were finding attractive and at the same time very, very new, and somehow reminiscent of what they've always known or something. Now, there's a joke about novelty being first perceived as being stupid, then as being banal, and then critics say, well, anyhow, I also knew it myself before. That's a joke, but that's put aside. This is not the main thing. But the Mandelbrot set, I was the first to see it. It was absolutely amazing the first few days. Then after a few days, I had a feeling that I've always seen it. I've always known it. And everybody who has been through it has the same feeling that, well, the fact is that fractals have been part of art, of painting, of decoration, of jewelry, of things forever, since time immemorial. So the biggest luck I had was that because of my willingness to take risks, because of my inquisitiveness, because of my willingness to follow the randomness of life, I followed ideas which led me to what is now, as I see it, one of the fundamental resonating cause of humanity, that for humanity, shapes, fractal shapes are extremely familiar. And now I see with different eye the painting of many great painters. Some of them were going away from fractality, others were at the contrary yielding to fractality, but they all knew about fractality, except that for them it was not at all a scientific abstract idea. It was just a way in which every well-schooled painter proceeds. The same thing for musicians, as a matter of fact. When Ligeti came towards me, since that's why I was there yesterday at this meeting, at this concert, whatever it is, he told me that in a way he had learned about fractality by trial and error without knowing that anything could be expressed in formal terms. So to be able to combine this very, very old history of humanity, the pleasure of shapes of certain complication, but organized complication, to combine that with mathematics and with physics and application and engineering devices, would have been absurdly unlikely if it were not something precisely very strong and very old. That is, the very fact that it works so well in so many areas must mean that it's not, a small wrinkle. But nobody's crazy enough to look for such ideas. So the fact that had I died or stopped working 10, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have known it. I wouldn't have known what I've worked on my life. So that's what I'm saying. Before, the being active at the advanced age gives this strange position of understanding one's own success or failure as not being as being luck, but not completely haphazard, if you want me to say it this way. That I did grab some idea which I couldn't express, which I followed. I was quite willing to abandon some work and to go from one field to another in ways which people found totally absurd, because one doesn't abandon a thing that works well. One does not resign from a famous university because one feels unhappy there. It's not done. You just suffer unhappiness. Well, I resigned many times. So I was following this idea which I could not myself express, and now I can, more or less. So it's I wouldn't call it self-organization, because it didn't happen by itself. I was working at it very hard to find rhyme and reason to all that. But, I don't think I have much else to say about it. I'm getting cold.
One second. Where did the concept of fractals come from? The word, the title.
The word. That story is fully documented. First of all, there are many words which mean nothing. That is, people invent words for an activity which doesn't exist. And some of them do it honestly. There was this French philosopher, Auguste Comte, who said that the science of society must one day exist. And I name it sociology. There was no sociology. A science of the mind must one day exist. I call it psychology. There was no psychology. But Auguste Comte felt that something could exist. Then many words exist for sciences which are just smoke and mirrors. I'm very conservative, which is sort of surprises some people, because they think that somebody who takes gambles must be, ready to do things. I didn't want to name my stuff anything until it existed. So I wrote a book about it, and a friend said the book it's fine, beautiful, etc. But you don't give a name to what you have identified, created, or whatever. So I went to my son's study. He was then, oddly enough, taking Latin, which was odd enough for America. Since he spoke fluent French, the French teacher had a few students in that class who were fluent in French, so he gave them Latin instead. And so there was a Latin dictionary in the house, which is no longer the case. And I was looking for words which meant broken up, in pieces, irregular. And the Romans, who were very down to earth, they were engineers and not thinkers, had a word for a stone which had been hit and broken to pieces. It was fractus. And that gave fraction, which has only the being broken into, but not the roughness. And gives fracture, which has the roughness, but not... But whatever, it was the right word, so I started playing with fractus and came with fractal, because I wanted it to be good in French and in English. Unfortunately, I don't remember the exact date, but within a month I could, because a version of the book before I changed it and a version of the book after I changed it. And the book had, this word had passed from document at birth to being in every dictionary, which was remarkably short, because after very few years, several dictionaries had it. I think now every dictionary has it. In fact, the origin is usually said rather accurately, and I think it was a good word.